Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. This week, we're taking an in-depth look at harm reduction programs like needle exchanges and what they can mean for their surrounding communities.
A syringe exchange program really should be called a harm reduction program.
But harm reduction isn't just about needle exchange. They also provide services such as treatment for hepatitis C.
That's new for us, seeing all kinds of hepatitis C come into the clinic. Yes, absolutely. And the treatment for that is very, very expensive, and the medications are over $100,000.
And we'll hear the human stories of addiction and recovery.
And that was my very first time snorting heroin. That's when my life changed forever. And things just only went downhill after that.
You'll find these stories and more this week inside Appalachia. Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. The opioid crisis is one of the biggest public health challenges in our region today. And it's not just those suffering from substance use disorder and their families who are feeling the strain. One strategy that's proven to help curb the epidemic's worst effects is to implement harm reduction programs, which generally offer a variety of services, the most controversial of which is needle exchange. But just because something's proven effective doesn't mean the public's bought into the idea. On today's show, we're going to learn more about harm reduction in Central Appalachia and how people have recently reacted to this idea. We'll also get to the heart of the matter by hearing from folks in Dayton, Ohio, talk about their stories of loss, love, hope, and recovery. We'll start with the story of Andre Lewis and his recovery sponsor, William Roberts. William works in social services in Dayton and is a church pastor with nearly three decades sober himself. Andre first met William at a treatment program for people who were struggling with addiction.
The day I met you, you sent me home because I was drunk. I used to go grab a pint of wine and put it in my pocket and then go to the meetings because I never would go to the meetings sober. That's what I remember. What do you remember about that day?
I remember you coming in and we kind of clicked. And at that time, we were having a talent show and we found out that you had the ability to sing.
We were singing the Temptations or something?
The Delphonics.
Yes, the Delphonics, right? So after that, I just like told myself, like, I need to ask him to be my sponsor. So I did. And he said, yes. And so he never left. When my mom passed, he was there. Everything that happened in my life, like tragic and happy, he was there. I was a boy in a man costume, you know what I mean? He showed me what a man looks like. My father, he was also an alcoholic, and he just yelled. But Mr. Bill, he'll talk to me in a way that I could just receive it, because I wasn't receiving my father. I wasn't at all.
You did well for a while, and then you relapsed. What happened?
At first, alcoholism was my problem. I was sober for maybe 8 years. I was working at CVS. Somebody had pills there. I ended up taking pills and started to like the euphoric feeling that they gave me. I had no idea that when you stop taking pills, you get sick. A guy across the street told me, he said, this what I got will cure your sickness. And that was my very first time snorting heroin. That's when my life changed forever. And things just only went downhill after that. It cost me the most important thing, my family. And I've experienced the loss of me. This heroin thing almost took me away from here because I OD'd twice. So I knew God had something for me here. But every time that I was in treatment, I'd done it for the wrong reasons. And you always check me on it. You'll let me go. Like, you'll get it. Yes.
Addiction is a disease where relapse is part of it. Each time I had to let go because you weren't ready and there was no need in both of us drowning. And so when you approached this last time, I think that you finally had hit a bottom and was ready for a different way to live.
And ever since then, I can't stop. It's just like my oldest is 25, my youngest is 12, going on 13. They're needing me. No matter what age your kids are at in their life, they'll always need their father. And I didn't understand that up until now. I got a question for you, though. How did it start all for you?
crack cocaine was my drug of choice. I went through the crack epidemics of the late 80s and 90s. It took everything. Family, anybody who loved me, ended up in jail with a felony record. And at the time, they had overcrowding in jails in Dayton, and they let me out. I had been trying to get in treatment centers, but they had a waiting list at the time. And I had to end up going to the treatment center for homeless people, which was the Salvation Army. Thank God that they were available. And I surrendered to the program. But I was not one who got it the first time either. I had 6 treatment interventions before it stuck.
Mr. B, if it wasn't for you, it took 14 years for me to get to this point and juncture. You are literally God's vessel navigating me to the point where I'm at right now. And I just want to say thank you.
Andre, I wanted to say to you, I am so proud of you for not giving up. It's been a pleasure watching you on this journey of recovery. This time, I don't want you to turn back, even during the scary times. Continue, because you mean a lot to me.
Thank you.
Love you.
Love you, too.
That segment was originally produced by Jess Mador as part of a 6-part series by WYSO called Recovery Stories. Geared toward people with intravenous drug use disorders, implementing needle exchange programs is one strategy that's proven to improve public health and to help combat a part of the substance use disorder epidemic. We reported last year on a program that was shut down amid public outcry. After that episode aired, we began to hear that people in other communities were questioning the need for similar programs around the state. So how does public acceptance impact public health? Carol Lofton did some digging and has more about not only the program in Charleston, West Virginia that shut down, but also other programs in West Virginia. Here's a quick recap. In December of 2015, with support from the City of Charleston, the Kanawha Charleston Health Department launched a harm reduction program, including a needle exchange. The primary goal was to reduce the risk of needle-borne diseases. The secondary goal was to connect illicit drug users to treatment and recovery services. An investigation into the program by the West Virginia Department of Health and Human Resources found several issues with the program and how it was run. The program closed a little more than 2 years after it opened amid controversy. Here's Kara's report.
The only thing that remains of the harm reduction program outside the Kanawha Charleston Health Department is a syringe kiosk where people can deposit used hypodermic needles. At its peak, the program served more than 400 people a week, mostly from Kanawha County, but surrounding counties as well, a factor that became a point of contention for many in the city. Outgoing Charleston Mayor Danny Jones has been outspoken on the issue.
It became basically a line of people just to line up to get needles on between 10 o'clock and 4 o'clock on any given Wednesday.
In the months before it closed, Jones publicly called the program a needle mill and mini mall for junkies.
On any given Wednesday, they might have given out 12,000 needles.
Actually, the average number of needles given out during the weekly Wednesday exchange was about 5,000, serving about 190 visitors. That's about 26 needles per person per week. The most needles the program ever gave out in a single week was just over 11,000 to 417 people. While 5,000 may seem like a lot, the average heroin user injects several times a day. So 26 needles a week gets a person about 3 injections a day with a clean needle.
A syringe exchange program really should be called a harm reduction program.
That's Dr. Artis Hoven, an infectious disease specialist with the Kentucky Department of Health. She says harm reduction is an all-encompassing idea to reduce the risk of many things associated with addiction.
Provide naloxone. Provide referral to care for people with substance use disorder. They do HIV and hepatitis C testing. They refer to care for those infected with HIV and hepatitis C.
And in Charleston, it seemed to work. While the Charleston program was open, the city did not see an HIV outbreak. 15 counties in southern West Virginia did have a small HIV outbreak. None of the original 3 counties involved had a harm reduction program. Recorded incidence of hepatitis C rates did increase during the course of the program, but so did efforts to test more people.
So we're doing rapid Hep C and HIV testing today. It takes about 20 minutes. Would you like to go ahead and get that taken care of while you're here?
But in Charleston, reports of discarded needles in the community began to skyrocket, and people were alarmed.
Needle pickup call. They had a needle that was left in a shopping cart. I want to see if somebody come pick it up.
Yep, I'll take care of it.
All right, thanks, sir. Appreciate it.
Firefighters reported having to crawl over them while putting out fires in abandoned structures. A local elementary school requested a biohazard container from the city so they could clean up an alley before school. And police officers reported finding huge numbers of syringes on people who were arrested. Both the Fraternal Order of Police and the Charleston Professional Firefighters Association wrote letters to city council expressing major safety concerns for first responders. Issues might have been exacerbated because the program grew really fast. In the 2 years the program was open, more than 651,000 needles were distributed. Only about 66% of those needles were returned. But according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the risk of contracting HIV is 0.3% for healthcare professionals stuck by needles on the job, which is why, for outside experts like Peter Davidson from UC California, needle litter is an annoyance, but not the major public health concern an HIV or hepatitis C outbreak would be.
No one in the world has ever obtained HIV by stepping on a needle in the street. Like, needles in the street are a piece of trash. You know, it's not something you want seeing laying in the gutter, but they're not actually a very hazardous object.
In some ways, it doesn't matter what the risk is. If someone finds a dirty needle on a playground or in a shopping mall bathroom, public reaction is strong. And for non-users, any risk of contracting HIV or hepatitis from a dirty needle is too much. But reactively closing a program in the biggest city in the state could have huge public health implications for the region.
And when needle exchange programs like the one in Kanawha County are shut down reactively.
That's former Commissioner for Public Health Rao Gupta in an interview shortly before he left his job.
And those decisions are not in the best interest of the community. I think it plays into the hands of that stigma. And it is more harmful long term than it is beneficial.
That was Dr. Rahul Gupta talking to Kara Lofton. Gupta said closing harm reduction programs harms the local community because it increases the risk of spreading needle-borne illnesses, and it also affects public perception and support for other harm reduction programs across the state that are trying to open or stay open. We're going to take a short break. We'll have more about the failed Charleston harm reduction program right after this. It's just enough time to pull up Inside Appalachia on your smartphone or computer. There, you can subscribe to the podcast and get a show delivered every Friday. That way, you can listen on your own time. We'll be right back.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
This is Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Part of an effective harm reduction program includes distributing clean hypodermic syringes. Research shows that in addition to reducing the incidence of bloodborne pathogens in the community, effectively run programs help remove potentially infectious syringes from the community. But some people, including then-Mayor Danny Jones, say that wasn't happening in Charleston. Reporter Kara Lofton discusses some of the issues with West Virginia Public Broadcasting's assistant news director, Glennis Board.
So, Kara, in your first report, you talked about how the number of discarded syringes people were finding in public places in Charleston began to explode. When did that happen, and what was the fallout?
So reports of needles found in public places in Charleston began to escalate about a year ago. In October of 2017, the Public Safety Office Metro 911 established a code for needle pickup calls to help the city accurately collect data on locations, numbers, and types of needles to be picked up. Let's listen to one of those calls.
Charleston Fire 48.
Hey, Metro. Got needle pickup.
I appreciate it.
And that's going to be in the alleyway on the ground. There's kids out with...
Oh, okay. I'll go get it.
All right, Dan. Thank you.
In an interview, Mayor Danny Jones said that the city tried numerous times to complain about needle litter. But then-Health Officer Michael Brummage took issue with the assertion that the health department ignored these complaints. And he pointed to attempts to address it, such as the founding of the statewide harm reduction coalition. Here's what Brummage said.
One of the objectives was to offload the city of Charleston so that there would be other programs so we didn't have to distribute as many syringes from the city of Charleston and that they would be able to go closer to where they lived.
So it wasn't long until the city came up with this idea of retractable needles, right?
Yeah, that's right. So about a week after the Metro 911 established a pickup code, the city proposed running a pilot program with retractable needles. And those are needles that once you use them, they retract back into a plastic chamber. And the idea was that if the needles could only be used once, then the risk of needle stick injuries to the community and then first responders as well would be much reduced. At the time, then-Health Officer Brummage was all for the idea. Writing in an email to City Attorney Paul Ellis, he said basically that the limitations are acceptability and cost, and if they got support or donated supplies, that he was for a pilot with evaluation from outside researchers.
So did they find someone to donate?
Yeah, they did. The Charleston Fire Department found a retractable needle manufacturer willing to donate needles in exchange for data on how well they worked. And everyone appeared to be on board with the pilot starting in the spring of 2018.
But wait, you said appeared. What happened?
Well, as he mentioned in the email, Brummage got in communication with a researcher at Johns Hopkins who told him that retractable needles were unpopular among IV drug users. For one thing, they can only use them once. So if they run out of needles, then users sometimes revert back to sharing equipment. So because of this, in 2010, the National Harm Reduction Coalition issued a statement against auto-disable syringes, saying that they don't help control epidemics of HIV, hepatitis C, and other bloodborne viruses among people who inject drugs, which is the whole point of doing a needle exchange in the first place. So Brummage told me he had to make a decision.
So at that point, I was kind of in a bind since I told the city we would implement the retractable syringe program. But now I knew if we did, we'd actually be putting the public at risk.
So given the current recommended practices, Brummage and the Johns Hopkins researcher decided to reduce the pilot from everyone at the health department to about 10 to 12 people. In meeting minutes from a call, Brummage's staff appeared to confirm the new plan with the company that had agreed to donate the syringes. Brummage says he then thought the needle manufacturer told the city about the change.
I see. But no one did?
No, they didn't. So city officials say they felt blindsided several weeks later when they learned that the pilot program no longer included the entire patient population and instead just 10 to 12 people. Here's Danny Jones.
And they refused retractable needles.
It was more complicated than that. But it honestly probably felt that way to the city due to the lack of or miscommunication, whatever you want to call it. And I mean, remember, law enforcement, emergency responders, and some members of the community were now expressing a lot of concern, and they felt like they had to do something. Danny Jones again.
I want to protect the public. I want to protect the law-abiding public.
So what did they end up doing?
In late March of this year, 2018, Police Chief Steve Cooper decided, as he was legally empowered to do, that among other things, only retractable needles may be lawfully distributed by the health department. Brummage again.
Basically directing the health department to adapt what appear to be from the medical literature dangerous and unethical practices.
But other experts say making a harm reduction program that fits the needs of the community takes a lot of compromise. Here's former Commissioner for Public Health, Rao Gupta.
Public health has never been and will never be about my way or your way. It will always be what's the best way to put science and marry that with art. and put it into practice.
But they ended up suspending the program, right? I mean, are there plans to reopen it?
Yeah, they did suspend it, and no, there are no plans to reopen it. But from a public health perspective, harm reduction programs are still the best tool the city has to prevent the spread of needle-borne illnesses. The science is pretty strong on that. But politically, from both Danny Jones and Dr. Michael Brummage, the program is dead in the water. That was Kara Lofton speaking with West Virginia Public Broadcasting Assistant News Director Glennis Board about the failed harm reduction program in West Virginia's capital city. In the southwest corner of Virginia, officials acted quickly, working out of fear for what could happen in their community if users continued to share dirty needles. Things in Big Stone Gap are playing out differently than they are in Charleston. Mallory No Payne from Virginia Public Radio visited Wise County to find out.
For years, substance abuse counselor Shirley Smith has worked with the homeless and addicted in Big Stone Gap. She's heard stories about how people get the needles they use to inject illegal drugs.
Yeah, but I had someone to tell me they went on a riverbank where they knew where the addicts used and all, and they went and picked these needles up and then resold them.
On the illegal drug market, dirty needles come cheaper than clean ones. Nurse practitioner Teresa Tyson has seen the impacts of that. She runs the nonprofit clinic, The Health Wagon. People with substance abuse disorder will come in with abscesses and skin infections. But that's not the worst of it.
That's new for us, seeing all kinds of hepatitis C come into the clinic. Yes, absolutely. And the treatment for that is very, very expensive. And the medications are over $100,000.
Tyson is well known for organizing the once-a-year remote area medical clinic. But she treats underserved patients all year long. She says Virginia is a wealthy state.
However, that wealth did not make it here to the mountains. We have a culture of extraction, and so once the coal was extracted, there's not a lot of resources that are left here. Our patients, they face a lot of like healthcare disparities in the region.
Disparities that Tyson has seen evolve into drug use, and now the rise of hepatitis C. For health officials, the fear is what could follow. According to the Center for Disease Control, parts of Western Virginia are some of the most vulnerable in the country when it comes to the rapid spread of HIV.
We know the possibility is coming, and we would not have enough, you know, resources to deal with that. And the reason that the harm reduction or needle exchange program was such a wonderful concept to have here so that we can get ahead of it.
Users can now go to the local health department for free, clean needles. Tyson has been referring not just her patients with substance abuse disorder, but also diabetics.
Unfortunately, our diabetics are forced with, you know, like reusing dirty needles and things like that. I mean, you know, it happens.
The exchange is run out of a brick building tucked among the trees on a dead-end road. In its first 5 months, about 30 people have visited regularly. To protect privacy, I couldn't record inside, but Counselor Shirley Smith has been there.
You go in the front and they'll lead you into the back where the needle exchange program is taking place.
Participants get canisters with clean needles, plus an ID card they can show police if they're stopped. So far, staff have collected far more needles than they've handed out.
And then they are asked if they'd consider recovery, so.
Some say yes. One has already been referred to Smith. Another counselor I talked to has also been in touch with a couple participants. Smith says the program helps plant a seed in people they couldn't otherwise reach.
If they're out on the streets using, they have no clue if there's help in recovery. But if they're coming into the health department, they are told about recovery. If we can help one, you've helped an entire family.
A handful of the needle exchange users in Wise have started treatment programs. One is sober and no longer injecting drugs. In Wise, I'm Mallory No Payne.
The research behind harm reduction programs is pretty unequivocal. These initiatives help save lives and prevent the spread of disease. But in order for harm reduction to be successful, most public health experts say the residents in the community have to support the program. Kara Lofton reports from Southern West Virginia.
Fayette County's harm reduction program started in October of 2017.
What do you know about our program here?
Nothing.
Okay, check it out. So we give you a kit. We give you 30 needles. You bring 30 needles back next week. We give you 30 more needles. You know why we do that?
During a recent clinic, a recovery coach met with a participant.
Did you do anything after that 28-day?
That's where I messed up, no.
Yeah, you didn't get a long-term treatment. No. How long ago was that?
Terry Harlan is the administrator.
Everyone understands that this drug epidemic is the biggest public health issue that we have dealt with.
She says the closure of the Charleston program is having a negative impact on public perception of harm reduction efforts in Fayette County.
I do feel like that what happened in Charleston definitely hurt us a little bit. When everything happened in Charleston and their harm they decided not to continue with their harm reduction program. We definitely started hearing people locally say, well, it didn't work in Charleston, so why would you keep, why would you keep doing that here? Even though there's lots of evidence and research out there that show that harm reduction does help to prevent the spread of disease and does help to get people the help that they need.
The trickle effect to other programs like Fayetteville's likely happened in the last 6 months the Kanawha Charleston program was open, when the narrative around the program became,
needles were everywhere, our property crimes went through the roof.
That's former Mayor Danny Jones. There was never a study done about whether the harm reduction program caused an increase in needle litter, so it's impossible to confirm the veracity of the claim. But we do know that during the 2 years the program was open, more than 650,000 needles were distributed, and only about 66% of them were returned. West Virginia University public health researcher Robin Polini says that doesn't mean all of those needles ended up on the street, though.
In West Virginia, it is legal to dispose of sharps, medical sharps, in the trash if you package them and label them in a certain way. And so the Charleston program, just like many other programs across the state, gives out puncture-proof containers and information on how to dispose of those safely, right? And so we don't have any idea how many of those ended up properly disposed of in household trash and how many didn't.
Dr. Susan Gardner is Assistant Dean of the University of Charleston School of Pharmacy, one of the volunteer groups very involved in the Kanawha Charleston Harm Reduction Program.
There are times where I just took a walk on the East End looking, saying, okay, if it's this bad, I've got to know whether it's this, surely I'll see it. And the only time that I've ever come across a needle in Charleston has been doing a syringe cleanup.
But without a study of Charleston's needle litter, there is also no way to prove that the 200,000 unreturned needles didn't end up on the streets either. Members of the Charleston Police Department say they've observed much less needle litter since the program closed. The department also has reams of photographs from first responders and community members of needles found in public spaces. And comments on news articles and Facebook posts seem to paint a community drowning in needles. But on some level, needle litter itself isn't the issue. Polini again.
And so part of the narrative that was built around the Kanawha program is this us and them of, like, we're the community and those people are drug users. Those people are part of our community. They're West Virginians.
Meanwhile, in Wyoming County, where Needle Exchange has been in operation since May, Executive Director Fred Cox says their program has been relatively well received. He guesses that's because they had a small HIV outbreak prior to the program opening.
A picture's worth a thousand words, I guess you'd say. So that picture really was quite clear to us here. And I think that really did help change some minds.
Do you think that if you had tried to do harm reduction before the outbreak, like as a preliminary sort of health prevention effort, that people wouldn't have been as accepting of it?
I do think that, yes.
Which brings us back to Charleston. Danny Jones.
It's not up to us to ruin a town over the fact that people have communicable diseases, and there were no reports of those kind of the hep C or the outbreak or the AIDS virus outbreak.
Every public health expert interviewed for this series said that from a public health perspective, harm reduction, including needle exchange, is not a controversial issue. former Commissioner for Public Health Rao Gupta says harm reduction is a multifaceted idea that encompasses not just needle exchange, but testing and family planning and treatment of diseases, too.
And then the other issues that come across that are consequential in some ways, like, you know, needle litter and other things, there have to be plans in place to address those. What we can't afford to do is ignore them.
There often are demands in public health, he said, to do things differently. But he believes there's always a middle ground you can get to with negotiation. And you do that, he says, because people's lives are at stake. That was Carol Lofton reporting from Southern West Virginia. Earlier in the show, we also heard about a program in Virginia that seems to be a success story. But despite approval by Virginia lawmakers, there are only three needle exchanges operating in that state. Mallory Nopain from Virginia Public Radio spoke to police in Southwest Virginia who have been grappling with this issue. Some were opposed to harm reduction programs, while others were supportive.
In Roanoke, Police Chief Tim Jones has a binder on his desk. It's full of newspaper clippings and research, all about needle exchanges.
Matter of fact, here is the PowerPoint presentation from the Virginia Department of Health.
He's looked at that presentation three times, but it still hasn't changed his mind. He's opposed.
Really,
he points to pamphlets that show how to use needles as safely as possible.
And this is one that really kind of rubs me the wrong way. Providers recognize that participants are experts in their own lives. Really? If I've got a substance abuse disorder, I think I've already messed that up. Obviously, they are not the experts in their own lives, or they wouldn't be coming to get free, clean heroin needles.
Needle exchanges are part of a strategy called comprehensive harm reduction. The hope is that if you get drug users in the door, you can provide other services like disease testing and recovery support. State officials have embraced the strategy, but others are not on board.
So if we as a community are endorsing and lifting up and supporting the use of heroin, what does that say to our kids?
Do you think that's what a needle exchange does, is endorses the use of heroin?
Absolutely.
Jones's resistance has led to a standoff in Roanoke, where city officials say an exchange would help battle rising rates of hepatitis C. But state law requires law enforcement to support the program, and Jones has refused to sign a letter of endorsement. One of his sticking points is that it's illegal to carry drug paraphernalia, and he's being asked to look the other way.
Reasonable immunities. You know, immunities to me translates to, give me a free pass, chief, if you catch me with a syringe and heroin on my person. As long as I can give proof that I'm involved in the harm reduction program. That doesn't work that way.
Roanoke isn't the only locality facing resistance from police. In a recent report, the Department of Health says lack of support from law enforcement has been a barrier in several jurisdictions. But not in Wise. The rural county is another 3 hours west of Roanoke. With the support of law enforcement, the health department here began a needle exchange this summer.
I'm Sheriff Ronnie Oaks, Wise County and City of Norton Sheriff, and I've been the sheriff here now. This is my 23rd year.
Oaks has seen the decline of coal in this community, followed by the subsequent rise of drug abuse. Through it all, he says, his job has been not just to enforce the law, but to help keep his community safe.
Are you not concerned that you're facilitating drug use, that you're making drug use easier?
Well, we don't feel like we are because we feel that these people who are going to use it and abuse it, they want to be safe as they can, if that's possible. And that's the reason they want to exchange the needle in the syringe program. They want to be involved in it. And if they do that, of course, it's helping us.
At first, Oaks was opposed. But after health officials told him it could help save lives, he reevaluated.
How many funerals have you been to from someone who's overdosed?
I've probably been to a dozen at least, yeah, over the years, to see the family who are there, and you try to have a good word to say to them, and nothing helps. But I don't know what we do, or, you know, we just keep trying to make a difference.
Since the needle exchange began, the health department has distributed more than 20 overdose reversal kits to people who have come in for clean needles.
at least 3 kits have already been used to revive someone. In Wise, I'm Mallory Nopain.
Okay, we just heard about how people in both Virginia and West Virginia are reacting to local programs. But what happens when communities reject best practices for harm reduction programs? Kara Lofton takes us back to Charleston to find out.
In late March, shortly after the Kanawha Charleston Health Department closed their harm reduction program, Mayor Danny Jones wrote in a letter to then Commissioner for Public Health Raul Gupta, asking that the West Virginia Bureau for Public Health perform an audit of the program. Raul Gupta.
The review provided very specific recommendations that needed to be met in order to restart the program.
These included improving data collection and analysis about exactly how many people were using the program and what services they were using, putting in place a plan to deal with needle litter, improving communication with community stakeholders, and requiring that people needing needles pick them up in person. After the audit came out, the Kanawha Charleston Health Department requested a review of the audit from 7 harm reduction experts around the country, including Dr. Peter Davidson from UC California. All 7 letters were pretty critical of the audit.
I think the best way to describe it is that the people who wrote the audit had a very particular idea in mind about what a syringe distribution program should look like.
In his letter, Davidson wrote, "Almost all of the recommendations in the audit represent severe and in some cases unconscionable barriers to effective, evidence-based primary prevention of bloodborne virus transmission."
You know, one of the reasons syringe distribution programs exist in the way that they exist at all is because the sort of traditional public health clinic model hasn't served people who use drugs very well at all and hasn't been very good at providing them with the basic tools they need in order to prevent the transmission of infectious disease and reduce overdose.
Davidson says ideally, harm reduction programs have as low a barrier of entry as possible, so the maximum amount of people will participate. And the recommendations made in the audit would raise the threshold of how easy it was to access resources. But he also says there's room to adjust programs to fit the communities they serve.
I wouldn't expect a needle exchange in rural Appalachia to look the same as a needle exchange in San Francisco, for example. That would likely lead to a program that didn't serve the population very well at all.
And in Charleston, there were actually 2 harm reduction programs being held simultaneously, but pretty differently. The one at the health department and a much smaller clinic-based program operated by HealthRight, the largest free clinic in the state. Angie Settle is executive director.
Back in 2011, we noticed an increase in patients that were coming in with various stories, histories of being diabetic. They would pick up the needles for the program, but not the insulin.
She says they began to suspect an increase in IV drug use among their patient population.
So we kind of quietly started the program with the needle exchange. It was mainly internal, not something we broadcasted. But those patients that needed it knew of the service, and as they came in, we were screening every patient for IV drug use.
Because HealthRight is a clinic working with a limited number of patients with whom they already have close relationships, they could run their program pretty differently than the health department, which was trying to do a mass public health push, serving the whole city. HealthRight is also a one-to-one exchange. You bring a needle back, you get a fresh one, which for most harm reduction experts is not considered best practice. But since patients can come as many times a week as they want, Settle said it seemed the best choice for her program. They also require every patient to meet with a counselor when they come in for needles. Basically, participation in HealthRight's program requires a lot more effort from patients, which means not everyone will use it. But Settle says that running a conservative program is preferable to not having a program available at all. Dr. Artis Hoven is an infectious disease specialist with the Kentucky Department of Health.
Yeah, the reality here is that you've got a drug-using population that, in fact, is going to keep using drugs whether or not you have a syringe exchange program or not.
But without a program, she says, the community is just opening itself up to easier spread of communicable diseases.
You know, there is something called the art and science, if you will, of risk or harm reduction. And for many of us, we're still learning what that art is and what the science is. We're trying to make it better
and to make it something that is more effective.
But if Charleston were to consider public health harm reduction again, a lot of community healing, conversations, and compromise would likely have to occur. And the biggest barrier may be one of the most intangible ones, addressing stigma. Lori Arian and Lori Yupa are two Ohio women who share more than a first name. Both have had children touched by substance abuse. The experience led Lori Arian to create the Dayton nonprofit group Families of Addicts, or FOA.
Two-thirds of American families have been touched by addiction. It is really hugely important that we get the word out that people can and do get better.
That mission brought Lori and Lori together, and in this story, they share how their lives have changed as a result of their children's addictions.
My son Chase Cummings was 18. He had passed away on September 18, 2012. He loved animals. He liked to do little rap songs. You know, we'd be in the car together, and he'd say a rap song, and I'd do one, and of course, we had a laugh at mine because my stuff didn't rhyme, and it was just silly stuff. He had potential, but he had the low self-esteem. He didn't want to come around the family because he felt like he was ashamed of what he had done. And the family at times would be like afraid to have him there because they're afraid he might steal something. Now, mind you, he was only doing this for 4 months, the heroin. His father had back pain, a lot of issues. He's taking oxycodone, Vicodin. Chase would get into that, and then it got into the heroin. Was clean for a couple months and then decided to use, and it killed him. Somebody injected him. And left him and stole his radio, his wallet, and his cell phone. And it's the worst feeling in the world to get a coroner's report on your child, to have the clothes he wore the last night he was alive, or things like that. I have a box with a bunch of his stuff in it, and, you know, once in a while I get into that box and I lose it, and that's okay. At first, when he passed away, I was like, gosh, why can't I save my child? You're supposed to protect him. But I couldn't.
My daughter is still living. There's days where I feel like I'm trying to keep her alive. April, it was 24 in April. She was due in May, so I didn't name her April because she was born in April. We've been on this journey for, I believe, about 7 years now. One day she was especially sick, so I took her to urgent care. And I saw the marks on her arms when she was laying there, and I said, "What is that?" And she said, "You know what that is." And that was the very first time I knew that she was using drugs intravenously. I had not even a clue. How would you ever think that your kid that is terrified of needles is going to wind up shooting heroin? I mean, it was unfathomable. That led us to years of rehabs with some success here and there. But I think what a really pivotal change for her was being locked up in Greene County Jail for 11 months. She got out and she did really, really well for, I think, almost a year. And then she decided to go off her medication and wound up relapsing that way. It's very nerve-wracking. I mean, I told her, don't use in my house because I don't want to have to revive you or find you. I would rather get a call. When I forbid had zero drug use tolerance in my home with her, what that it is, it's just promoted lying because she didn't feel she could come to me. And I'm really just trying to let her figure it out for herself. She knows what she needs to do.
You don't want to force her because it's not going to work. You can pray, beg, cry, carry on, and plead with them to please get better, please stop. But unless they want to, they're not going to. That's one thing I do know.
There may come a day where I don't know what's supposed to happen with her. And hopefully I can be as healthy about it as you seem to be. And I know it's taken you a really, really probably long time to be able to have some type of acceptance and peace about it. Is that how you feel?
Yeah, I do. I will never wrap my head around it. I know my son's gone. I know he's in heaven. But I cannot wrap my mind around the fact that he's dead. My mind don't go there. I remember driving down the highway and think to myself, that cement block under 675 bridge, I'm going to run into it and just end it because that's how bad it affects the whole family. I have another son, Chad, who's getting married. He is my world. If I didn't have that kid, I don't know what I would do. My son, who's healthy, has always done right, good boy. My son has said to me, Mom, you know you have another son, and that makes you feel horrible. I was so consumed in the grief of losing Chase, But, you know, I have to live for him and I have to live for others. And that's what gives me joy. That's what helps me keep going.
You know, we've got a granddaughter on the way, first time ever. I want to make the time for my son, his girl, and the baby. That might change how I support April. There comes a certain point where I got to do things for my other child, and I'm not willing to miss out on it.
Nope.
I feel like I have a bond with you from that very first day.
Me too. I was so gung-ho. I wanted to help, 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 and they gave me your name and number, and ever since then, it's been on like Donkey Kong, girl. She's just someone that's there for me, and I'll be there for her. I will always volunteer at every rally. I love doing that. I love you.
I love you, too.
Chase's story is part of a 6-part series produced by Jess Mador called Recovery Stories. We've posted a link to the stories on our website at wvpublic.org. Public health and addiction experts say one of the biggest battles in drug treatment and recovery is overcoming stigma, which, as we heard, was part of the challenge in the failed Charleston, West Virginia program. We also learned about what happens when a community rejects a needle exchange program. In our final report in the show, Kara explores how the failed Charleston needle exchange has affected the community's perception of harm reduction usefulness. She found that things like harm reduction, safety, and crime have become as much about politics as public health.
10-4, thank you, Sergeant.
Sergeant Matt Webb has been on the Charleston Police Force for 20 years.
He
said during that time period, the department's seen a big increase in drug-related crimes.
I mean, that's some of the stuff that people don't really think about, or, you know, it's the bigger picture of the drug issue. This guy's out stealing somebody side by side. Those people probably work hard every day to try to take care of their families and have things like that. And here he is trying to support his drug habit. He goes and steals a side-by-side.
During the 2018 mayoral election, crime and safety related to the drug epidemic became a political theme.
One of the issues we have in our downtown area that is not just perceptions become reality, unfortunately, is there is a belief that there is a public safety issue in downtown Charleston.
That was mayoral candidate J.B. Akers during a fall debate between him and then-candidate Amy Goodwin, televised by WCHS. Akers was publicly critical of the syringe exchange component of the Charleston Harm Reduction Program during his campaign. In the months leading up to the election, the program increasingly became a politically charged, divisive issue. This fall, the city of Charleston completed a $100 million renovation on the Charleston Civic Center. The Civic Center overlooks the Elk River and abuts the Charleston Mall. On the other side, the Kanawha Charleston Health Department.
That health department shouldn't be there.
That's outgoing Mayor Danny Jones, who was a supporter of Akers. The Charleston Harm Reduction Program happened once a week, and as the program grew, that meant that up to 400-some patients were coming through in a 6-hour period for needle exchange, as well as getting vaccinations, testing for diseases, and accessing family planning services, among others. This volume was a big deal for the downtown community. Former city health officer Michael Brummage says he'd likely rethink the location of the harm reduction program.
Having a program that was outside the city limits, or at least within the city limits but in a less trafficked place by regular business people and people doing shopping in the city of Charleston, would be an important thing to do as well.
Over the last couple of years, complaints of vagrancy and a rise in a criminal transient population have increased, a change Jones attributes to the harm reduction program and the geography of the state.
It's the confluence of the interstates.
Charleston is at the intersection of two major interstates, 64 running east to west and 77 running north to south, which Jones says made it easy for people outside of the city to come in and utilize resources meant for residents. Sergeant Webb.
I know it's been a long time since I started this profession, but when I first began, I knew of two homeless people in town. And now, I mean, they're all over the place.
Is that addiction or economy?
Don't those go hand in hand? I'm pretty certain the addiction aspect of what we're dealing with has a lot to do with economy. When you're feeling down on yourself, you look for ways to make yourself feel better. I'm far from a doctor. but I'm sure a lot of people that are out here addicted to drugs have had some kind of traumatic experience, or they're trying to fix something.
A few months after the program closed, a Facebook group started called Charleston Has Had Enough, where members post photos of other people using drugs, stealing packages, panhandling, etc. Now, almost one of every 10 Charleston residents is a member. None of the 10 admins or moderators returned a request for an interview. But in a September 16th post, one of the founders wrote, "Word is going around that this group is all about shaming junkies. Anyone who believes that is an idiot. No, this is a group about shaming the so-called leadership that got us in the mess, namely the Kanawha County Health Department, who convinced the city that free needles were a great idea." Danny Jones is a member. He says the group is giving people a place to vent.
It was a really bad situation for our city. Needles were everywhere. Our property crimes went through the roof. And now that it's over, our property crimes have gone way down.
That's a slightly misleading assertion. Larceny, meaning theft of personal property, has actually fallen considerably from 2014 to 2017, according to data obtained by West Virginia Public Broadcasting from the Charleston Police Department. Burglary or breaking and entering spiked in 2016, the first full year the program was in operation, but then fell to pre-program levels the second full year the program was in operation. Breaking and entering in a car has risen continuously since 2014, and there was a massive spike in auto crimes in 2016 and no decline during the program's second year. But the data doesn't make it clear why some crime went up after the harm reduction program opened and some went down, and speculations only seem to divide the community. In an off-the-record conversation, a member of the Charleston Fire Department said the closure of the Charleston program has set the city back 10 years in terms of acceptance of harm reduction. How to move forward is a subject incoming Mayor Amy Goodwin addressed in the October debate televised by WCHS.
Leaders lead. Leaders don't take the blame or cast the blame onto someone else. They look at what they've done wrong and they say, let's improve it. They look at something that may be a problem in the city and they work with everyone. They bring everyone to the table. They don't villainize, they don't marginalize folks.
At this point, bringing everyone to the table is going to take a lot of work, but it's not impossible. Sergeant Matt Webb.
You know, I would be interested in being on some kind of board, or, you know, when they hold discussions and about trying to figure out answers to these questions.
Whether such a board is created, or even if enough people are willing to sit down and really listen to one another to address the still present public health risk of needle-borne diseases, remains to be seen.
On this show, we've learned about harm reduction programs in West Virginia and Virginia. Some have closed down while others are still in operation, counting the needles distributed and the number of participants choosing to look for help. Studies show that these programs will work, but only when they're implemented correctly. Since we already see such strong stigma associated with addiction and recovery, we really don't have room to get harm reduction wrong. In this region, in this type of work, there's no room for mediocrity. So let's dust ourselves off, learn from it, and get back to work. Till next week, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from West Virginia Public Broadcasting's health reporter Kara Lofton and WYSO's Jess Mador, along with Mallory No Pain from Virginia Public Radio. Music in today's show was provided by Dinosaur Burps, Blue Dot Sessions, and Ben Townsend. Roxy Todd is our producer. Eric Douglas is our associate producer. Our executive producer is Jesse Wright, who also edited our show this week. Our audio mixer is Patrick Stevens. You can find us online on Twitter at InAppalachia. You can also send us an email to InsideAppalachia@wvpublic.org. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia at West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. If you'd like to listen to any part of this episode again, don't forget you can subscribe or download all of our stories at wvpublic.org, and you can find Inside Appalachia on Apple Podcasts or wherever podcasts are found. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.